Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 FM KALW, Information Radio for San Francisco and beyond.
Yes, our conversation picks up themes that we discuss all the time at Philosophy Corner at Stanford University.
Sometimes we like to dig into specific philosophers' views, and we're going to do that today. We're going to talk about some of the elements of the philosophy of Karl Marx.
Now, Ken, I guess we're going to put the emphasis on philosophy here. That is, we're not interested in but we're not going to talk about the fascinating history of the influence of Marx's ideas on the 20th century. We're interested in what he said that would have been there even if he'd never had any influence on anybody.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. But we might talk about whether his influence on the 20th century was pernicious or for the good, but you're right. We're gonna dig into the philosophical ideas.
Okay, so what are his big three ideas?
Oh man, he's got lots of big ideas. He's got the labor theory of economic value. You know, labor is the source of value. He's got an explanation of the dynamics of capitalism, and he's got this historical thesis called historical determinism. He has all kinds of ideas. There's a nice idea, though, that maybe we can focus on to start with before we get into all this Marxist stuff, this notion of alienation and alienated labor, because that's a kind of a pretty fundamental notion in Marx.
So now this is an early idea that goes back to when he was a student studying Feuerbach, I guess. And as I understand it, it goes something like this. I mean, let's say, what would it be to not be alienated? Suppose I'm living in the woods all by myself, and I decide that I'm tired of sleeping under a tree. I want a house. So I decide to build a house. I cut down all the trees, put it together all by myself, do all the jobs. And then it's mine and I live it. So that's pretty unalienated,
yeah,
right? It's my house and it's mine in every respect.
Yeah, you might not have. I mean, in the woods, Marx might have thought you might have had some people helping you, but you would have built it together. It would have been yours together, maybe. But then alienation comes in. Lots of different places, but suppose that your wife says to you, "Build that house, John." So she commands you to build it.
I say, "But honey, we're happily sleeping under the trees. I don't want to build a house."
No, but you're going to build it anyway.
You're going to build that. So then I'm a little bit alienated.
Yeah, you're
from
a lot alienated because you're alienated from the very process of deciding what to do with your labor. Right now, suppose that your wife also takes over the house and kicks you out.
Uh-huh.
Right now, you don't own the house anymore. I mean, you created it. You had no say in this decision making. You created it. Now you're alienated from this product that stands over against you, as Marx would put it, as an alien thing.
Okay, so it's my house is of me, but it's not mine anymore. But now Marx was particularly interested in cooperative labor. Suppose we in the philosophy department decide to cooperatively put out an edition of Marx, and we all work together on it. Is that unalienated labor?
Well, it depends. Now, if we all work together on it, fully, freely, autonomously, all participating in the plan. But suppose I'm going to just reduce you to the guy who puts the umlauts on, and that's all you do. And you're kind of a mechanized umlaut putter-runner. Then you're alienated.
I'm going to feel somewhat alienated. I'm going to say, well, I was involved in this, but it's not really mine.
Yeah.
And then if Stanford University wants to own it and to have all the profits, well, I'd be further alienated.
Yeah. Now, communism, one of the things it's supposed to do is overcome alienation. Alienation is part of the human condition under capitalism. Communism is going to help us overcome that.
So are communists, unlike me, just kind of happy little unalienated people?
Well, why don't we talk to one? Our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, did just that. She files this report.
My father, Paul Kornbluth, was a communist. He believed there was going to be a violent communist revolution in this country, and that I was going to lead it.
Josh Kornbluth is a performer living in San Francisco. His monologue, Red Diaper Baby, which was just made into a movie, is about growing up, as he describes it, in the communist faith.
As a kid, that was not only a serious thing, but totally inevitable, because my dad told me it was, that there was going to be a communist revolution in this country. What he would say is, not in my lifetime, but in yours. I was supposed to read Marx, it was assigned, and I read a bunch of it, but, you know, man, it's actually rough going when you try reading it. A lot of footnotes. And I called Dad at home, because I was at college. I said, "Dad, you know, Marx is sort of a drag, you know, the Grundrisse." And my father said, "You don't have to read it, it's in your blood." By the way, my dad, he never followed sports. I just want to say, when Cincinnati won the World Series, There was a huge banner thing on the sports page that said Reds win. My father, he just loved it. It was like he just took a moment to just make believe. The idea of communism that my father conveyed to me, it's a utopian ideal, and it was and is just beautiful. I mean, it's this idea that people shouldn't exploit other people. The people who produce this stuff should own this stuff. The idea of that is wonderful, and it's very, you know, what's not to like? The argument against it is in the execution of it. And execution is probably an unfortunately apt word. You're a kid, you look out at the world and you see the abundance that America has. And then you see how many people are poor, for example, and how many people are starving. And you know that it's not necessary. You know, we'd walk around from the Lower East Side where my dad lived up Park Avenue, and we'd go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, in neighborhoods where people had mansions. And you come from our own tenements, which were smaller, but then you see people who are much worse off, and it just is, it's a crying shame. It's criminal, it's horrible, it's disgusting that we can't share our resources that we have. It does seem not impossible to me that if humanity survives, that there will be a time when there won't be a class system. Is that possible? Like, is it possible within human nature not to compete? Is it possible? I don't know. There are these people who believe in, who are loving people, and they have a loving view of humanity and of nature. And despite all of the evidence to the contrary, they have an optimistic view. You know, I see that among, you know, Jews and among Christians and among communists and among capitalists. I think that there are just a bunch of people in the world who are loving people. They have these different beliefs, but they're the same belief to me in some sense, that we're all in this together. That to me is the essence of the beauty of communism.
Monologist Josh Kornbluth from a report filed by Amy Standen. Kind of nostalgic but alienated memories of a communist youth. I'm John Perry alongside my colleague Ken Taylor, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk.
And our guest today joins us from the BBC Broadcasting House at Portland Place in London, England, all the way across the continent and an ocean. That's Jonathan Wolfe. He's a professor of philosophy at the University College London, and he's author of the very readable, I've been reading this book, and very informative book, Why Read Marx Today. Jonathan, it's a pleasure having you with us. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Hi, Jonathan. John Perry here.
I got two Johns here. This is
yeah, two Johns, right.
Call me Joe.
Okay, I'll call you right. Joe. That's okay. Good. Yeah. Right. You can call me anything. Just don't call me late for dinner. Ha ha. Joe, we've been talking a little bit about Marx's concept of alienation. Is this an important key to a lot of his later politically oriented thought?
It is. And by the way, I thought you did an excellent job explaining a lot of this concept. One thing maybe you missed out, if you don't mind me saying so.
No, we don't. Not at all.
Really, factors about the economic structure and the way that, in Marx's view, contributes to alienation maybe is even one of the most important aspects of it. I mean, for Marx, a theme that recurs again and again in his writings, early and late, is that under capitalism, all of us, you and me, even the capitalists, we're playthings of alien forces. We're controlled by these forces that are outside our own control. And this is really, he thinks, the great problem with capitalism.
Why is the capitalist a plaything? I can understand why the worker is, because he doesn't own the means of production. His work is what, de-skilled, right? He does this boring, repetitive thing. He doesn't take part in the decision-making process of what's to be produced and what isn't. Why is the capitalist, though, alienated?
Well, the thing that got me interested in this was a comment by Margaret Thatcher, who said publicly, you can't ignore market forces. You can't turn your back on market forces. And it was the first time I'd heard that phrase. I didn't know what a market force was, really. It sounded a bit like, you know, a natural force. That is, you know, if you turn your back on a natural force, if you ignore gravity, then you're going to come to harm. But the American version of this, I think, is that you can't buck the market. Even the most powerful capitalist is controlled by market forces. I mean, Marx has a brilliant example of this in, you know, the 19th century England. A group of manufacturers felt that they were over-exploiting children. That at the time, the average working day for children, even as young as six, was about 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. The capitalists wanted to cut the working day. They thought they couldn't, because if they did, they'd go out of business.
Right.
But the capitalists aren't quite the objects of sympathy that the workers should be there. I mean, Marx doesn't say, capitalists of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains.
Well, that's right. He didn't think that they were going to be the revolutionary class. That's true. All I'm suggesting is that we all lose out through capitalism, according to Marx.
Right. I mean, the communist revolution is supposed to be a liberating revolution for humanity at large, right? It's supposed to be a kind of, it's a deep humanistic vision of how we can all live together and enjoy, what does he call it, our species nature, right, as cooperating, autonomous.
Yeah, humanity. But there's a lot of big words, species, nature, alienation, so forth. I mean, come on, really. Suppose I've got a job putting the fenders on Edsels or Fords or whatever. I mean, is that, you know, the product of my labor isn't mine. It belongs to the guy who employs me. What's so bad about that? What's so bad about alienation? Don't call it alienation. Call it the fact that you make things that don't end up being yours.
Especially, Joe, if I pay John a good wage for his
Henry
his
Ford, $5 a day.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, he sells his labor to me. He sells it to me. I don't steal it from him.
Yeah. Well, I must say, I don't think this point about someone else owning the product of your labor is really the most important thing for Marx. Because even under communism, you're not going to be consuming everything you produce. And one thing that Marx is very clear about is that under communism, you will be fulfilling other people's needs, not just your own. The important points, I think, are, first of all, that according to Marx, we all have a species nature, a species essence. We are human beings with a will and a consciousness. We can create, we can imagine, we can build. Marx says we can even build in accordance with the laws of beauty, not just out of necessity. We all have these powers, and we can express them in our labor, but Marx thinks under capitalism, most of us just don't have that opportunity. We produce on the level of animals, he says.
Is that because of the division of labor inevitably makes that happen? Is that the idea? I mean,
well, the division of labor can be very powerful because division of labor can allow some people to concentrate on tasks which are extremely fulfilling, like an architect, for example. But it's more of the type of de-skilling that tends to go along with labor. I mean, it's been said that the average worker exercises more skill driving to work than they do at work. This doesn't seem to be the right way to live our lives, certainly according to Marx.
Maybe not according to Marx, but one wonders. I mean, driving is a big enjoyable thing for a lot of people. Is that such a bad system where you get your thrills away from work?
If you're listening to Philosophy Talk, we are examining the theories of Karl Marx. Our guest today is Jonathan Wolfe of University College London. He's coming to us all the way from London. We invite you to join us as well. The number is 415-841. That's 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, we
the
don't
phone
want that
lines
number
are
to
closed.
Get alienated from itself, Ken. 415-841-4134. Do you find Marx's concept of alienation a helpful one in thinking about things? Class struggle? Let us know. To what extent do you folks out there, most of you who lived through the 20th century, a good part of it, think that Marx's philosophy did actually lead to the tyrannies of Lenin, Stalin, and Mao? Again, the number, 415-841-4134, or go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Billy Bragg and chorus singing the Internationale. I'm John Perry. You've dialed into Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing Karl Marx with Jonathan Wolf. You know, in addition to being a professor of philosophy over in London at the University College London, Joe is an author of Why Read Marx Today? There was a time when there wouldn't have been any need to ask that question because, you know, people at the barricades, young men and women bent on changing the world, were reading Marx. But why should we read it now?
We'd like you to join our conversation about Karl Marx. The number is 415-841-4134 or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Jonathan, you make Marx sound like he has a lot of, thinks he has a lot of knowledge about essences. The essence of humans is to do this and so forth. That reminds me of some neocons I talk to who think they know what the essence of human nature is. It's to be free and so forth. How does any of these philosophers know what the essence of human nature is? Maybe the essence of human nature is to, you know, be born, work a while, have some fun, have some kids, be a little bit free, be a little bit alienated, and move along.
Well, that may be true. I mean, what's interesting about all of them is that they fail to give us many arguments. But I think for Marx, essence really should be understood in terms of potential. What can each of us do? That in the 19th century, before digital cameras, people would sketch when they went on vacation and come back with amazing sketches that none of us would feel we could do now. If we sat down, if we were taught, we could do those things. We can play musical instruments. Many people can sing, can write poetry. But what do? We drive to work. We do our job. We get paid. We go home. We watch television. We go to bed. We get up and we repeat it. So Marx thought that most of us were just not using any percentage of our real potential.
So essence really is a little highfalutin for what he had in mind. He thought there was a realm of human possibilities. They were open to each of us, and most of us didn't take advantage of them, and that the form of the economic forces and so forth bore at least part of the blame for that. That all sounds pretty sensible to me.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. I mean, Marx has this, calls himself a dialectical materialist. That's really fancy sounding expression. But I think there's something deeply right about that, because as I understand it, tell me if I'm wrong, Joe. We create, the world is material. It's not just of ideas like, Kant or somebody would have thought it. It's a world that we make, a material world that we make. And in making it, we also set the conditions of our own lives and affect ourselves. And so we change in consequence to our own making of the world. I mean, that sounds kind of undeniably true to me. First, have I got that right about Marx, roughly, dialectical materialism?
That's how I understand it. I mean, one small thing to say, though, Marx never called himself a dialectical materialist.
You're kidding.
This was a term that Engels introduced. And so there's a certain amount of confusion about what Marx said, what Engels said. Marx had the misfortune, really, that Engels outlived him. And so Marx could no longer censor Engels' writings after his death. And so a lot of things that are suggested as Marxist philosophy are actually Engels' own rather amateurish attempts to come up with a Marxist philosophical system, unfortunately.
And then how about Lenin's philosophical attempts? Were they amateurish too, do you think?
Well, Lenin at least had some sort of training. I have to say, in terms of the philosophical works of Lenin, I'm no expert there. I don't know who is these days.
Maybe Anne in San Francisco, who's on the line, is an expert. Anne, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I don't think there are experts in anything.
Okay, so what's your question or comment?
Except God is the expert. Didn't he make the primary reality materialism, that only the material exists? I mean, what could be more incorrect than that? It eventually made like a dictatorship of the people, but we didn't see that under communism. We saw an enslavement of the people by the socialist state ownership of everything.
But Anne, how do you get from materialism, the world just being physical or material, to this horrible result? Do you think those are two are really intimately connected?
I didn't hear the first part very well. What you the matter. He made that like a god in itself. Matter was the sole base, and economics was the sole basis of this society. But only matter really existed. That's all what he believed, that only matter was existed.
So, Anne, thanks, Anne. I take it, Anne, that you think that Marx went wrong in not letting God into the picture, but Marx said something very powerful about religion, that it's the opiate of the people, and that had something to do with alienation.
And masses, right? Opiate of the masses. You've destroyed the poetry of this phrase.
Jonathan, help me illuminate that phrase. Religion is the opiate of the masses.
It's an interesting phrase, that's for sure. I've had students who've thought that, well, if Marx thought that religion was the opium of the people, maybe religion's not such a bad thing after all. But
I see. The reverse effect on today's youth. Yeah.
But I mean, what we have to remember is that in Marx's day, opium was primarily used as a painkiller. There weren't other painkillers. And for Marx, it's important to realize that opium has a number of effects on the people who use it. Sure, it takes away people's pain, but it also creates illusions, delusions as well. And it also, Marx thinks, creates long-term damage. I mean, it's very interesting. In Capital, Volume 1, he talks about nursing mothers returning to the production line. And of course, the production line wouldn't stop for these mothers to nurse their babies. So what they used to do was to swaddle them in tight clothes and feed them something called, I think it was called Godfrey's cordial, to keep them quiet. Godfrey's cordial was an opium. And so these mothers could work by feeding their babies opium. So, now, Marx has a similar idea about religion's effect on the mothers, that if the mothers believed in God, then they would keep working.
Right, so religion kind of makes us content with the human condition. We invent religion because the human condition is so miserable, right? We recognize the misery and we want to cope with it, and we invent religion to somehow comfort us with That's the misery right. of the human condition. And by doing that, we don't really deal with the misery of the human condition.
These ideas, I think he picked up a lot of them from Feuerbach, isn't that right? I mean, this whole idea of God, man creating God and so forth and so on.
They're much older ideas than that. I suppose they go back to the ancient Greeks, in fact. They've mm-hmm. always been with us. But Marx was very strongly influenced by Feuerbach. I mean, what Marx thought was wrong with Feuerbach's analysis was only that it wasn't deep enough, that Feuerbach hadn't explained how we get rid of these illusions.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Jonathan Wolfe from the University of College London. You can join us by calling 415-841-4144.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
We're eager to hear your voice. And somebody's we have callers in the line. Bashada in Berkeley is on the line. Did I get that right, Bashada?
Yeah. How you doing?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My God, I don't know where to begin, where to end. This is a lovely discussion. But let me start with the issue of the capitalist and the worker. I don't like the term labor. The United States likes to give a fluffy description to things many times. So I want to talk about the worker and the alienation, because you can't have alienation, even though it is true that the capitalist will feel the market forces are stronger than he or she is. However, the capitalist has the decision and has the power, because he is the one taking surplus value. The worker, as alienation, is quite different, because he can lose his whole livelihood if he doesn't work. And the whole point about alienation for Marx was that the working class itself is the essence of the surplus value. And this is why he laid the responsibility and the task for liberation of the society on the working class.
So Bashada, could you explain in a sentence what Marx's concept of surplus value is?
Well, the best way I can explain it, which is maybe one of your guests is better astute than I am in this one, but let's assume you have a production line in which you put sugar and coffee and whatever the raw materials are. And from the beginning to the end, from the moment you, let's say, pick up something off the field up to the last minute, something is in as a finished product. When you add them together, let's say, assume you have, including labor, for whom you pay, let's say, $2. mm-hmm. and sugar is $3, blah, 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 blah. You put them together, you're supposed, let's assume, to get a $10 value at the end of the product line, but you end up with 15. Okay? Marx reversed the formula. I wanted to see where that extra 5 came from that we call in our...
profit.
Pardon?
Profit is what we call it.
Profit. What yeah. we call it is profit.
Yeah.
True. So this is where the surplus value is, that it has to come from somewhere because there is exchange, there is, you know, the barter system. Right. It's a very big and deep thing that cannot be explained. So
thanks, Bishada. Thanks, Bishada. Joe, what do you think? Has Bishada got that explanation of surplus value correct, more or less?
Yeah, he has. I mean, there's another way of illustrating, I think, that might be simpler. If you take a very simple model of an economy where you have someone who's just working to make loaves of bread. Now, his wages, according to Marx, will be whatever is necessary to keep him alive for the day. The wages are determined by a subsistence value. Now, suppose it takes that worker just one loaf of bread. The worker can survive on one loaf of bread. Well, that means the wages of that worker, according to Marx, will be enough to buy just that one loaf of bread. But if this guy's a baker, then maybe he's making two loaves of bread. And so the product will sell for much more than the wages and the cost of the raw materials. So that is a surplus value that's created, the difference between what the worker costs plus the raw materials and what the capitalist will get through a day's work.
Why does the capitalist get to keep it and not the worker? Why doesn't the worker say, hey, I want more? This thing, I just gave you $10 worth of labor. I gave you 10 units worth of labor. You only paid me 3 units. Why doesn't the worker demand more?
Well, two answers to that, really. I mean, one is that for Marx, the value of anything is determined by the cost of producing it. So the value of the day's labor is one loaf of bread. And so in that sense, the worker isn't being cheated. Marx says it's a piece of good fortune for the capitalist, but no injustice to the worker. That's one answer, not very satisfying. The other answer is just that the worker is in a very bad bargaining position.
Yeah.
The worker has no access, no independent access to the raw materials. And Marx tells an excellent story about an industrialist who goes off to Australia from England, taking with him, I can't remember how many, 500 workers or something, thinking that the cost of production in Australia would be so much cheaper. What he found was as soon as he got there, everyone ran away because they could go and farm for themselves.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor Jonathan Wolfe from the University of College London. He's author of the very fine book, very readable book, Why Read Marx Today. And if you read this book, it'll encourage you to go read Marx. It won't be a substitute for reading Marx. We have some callers on the line. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. Add your voice to this discussion. And Judd in San Francisco has done just that. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Judd.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear
you. Good. Well, listen, I think the future approach will be using, I know I've been using a red umbrella as an icon to great minds think alike. But I think what we have to do when we read Marx and when we read all the other philosophers is take out their ideas. For example, the utopian ideal. If people were to say to me, what is the tradition that you wish to perpetuate, I'd say the utopian tradition. And that would include things like an optimistic view of there must be a better way, cooperative labor, we're all in this together. All these maybe 50 or 60 ideas that we can pull out of Marx without necessarily having to accept the ideology that we have to do away with private property or that we have to have a Führer or a dictator or a Stalin to tell us. But thank good for Stalin. I think we would have lost World War II if it wasn't for somebody like Stalin.
But now, Judd,
see my point of view?
Thank you very much, Judd.
Yeah, utopia means, you know, perfect place, and who can argue with having a perfect place? But most visions of utopia, if for one thing, not everybody agrees that they're very utopian. They don't sound perfect to one person, even though they sound perfect to another person. And most attempts to have utopias fail miserably because no one can kind of figure out and put into practice the things that'll make them work. Isn't utopia a bit of an illusion?
But John, I think Judd has an important point. I want to press Jonathan on it. Marx was obviously wrong about lots of things, like this theory of surplus value. I don't think any economist would endorse it. I mean, because it'd be labor. Why should labor create the surplus anyway? I mean, he had this theory about the inevitable, progress of history that seems to have been wrong. I mean, and the states that were founded on roughly Marxist ideals, they mostly went asunder. But now the question is that enough to like refute Marx or show that Marx is irrelevant or not worth reading or what, Jonathan? I hope that's a softball for you.
Well, the Marx the critic I find much more impressive than Marx the prophet. Perhaps I misspoke there. Marx the prophet is very impressive as long as you don't try to live in his prophecy. The critique of capitalism that Marx gives, I think, is really very penetrating and still relevant today. I mean, let me just give you one example. One of my favorite concepts from Marx's economic writings is something that sounds on the face of it very dull, the concentration of capital. Now, this is defined in terms of the amount of social wealth or material wealth that's held in the form of capital, which sounds like a rather technical economic term. But it's a profound concept with profound consequences. I mean, the idea is that in any society, there will be sources of wealth that are not traded or part of the formal economy. So, for example, the things you get from your friends and family, these are wealth to you, a source of rich enrichment, a source of riches, but they're not things that you buy and sell. Similarly, if you grow your own food, make your own clothes, these are forms of wealth, but they don't go through the economy as such. They're not being bought and sold. Now, the idea of concentration of capital is just the idea of how much social wealth is held in the form of capital. Now, we can think of this as how much actually goes through the formal economy. Now, what Marx predicts is that as capitalism develops, more and more social wealth will be held in the form of capital, i.e., the concentration of capital will grow. Another way of putting this is that more and more things will get sucked into the formal economy. And certainly we see this, that childcare, for example, is an economic transaction, care for the elderly, gardening, cooking, making clothes, all of these things were once things people did for themselves or their friends. They're all now pulled into the economy.
I want to take that up with you when we come back after a break, Jonathan, because I think that's a pretty profound point in Marx. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Joining us from London is Jonathan Wolfe, author of Why Read Marx Today. We'd like you to join our conversation. You can do that by calling 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation
Ask
of
yourself,
Philosophy Talk.
Is Marx living
the phone
or
lines are closed.
Dead? Is there anything in Marx that speaks to us today? That number is 415-841-4134. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. Here comes that working man.
Merle Haggard singing the working man's blues. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about Karl Marx here with my colleague Ken Taylor and Jonathan Wolfe. I just want to mention that if you're intrigued by Marx, you can pick up lots of editions of Marx's books, from the little an easy-to-read Communist Manifesto that he wrote with Engels to his magisterial Das Kapital. It may take you a while to get through at your local bookstore in many editions. Two excellent secondary sources are a book by our guest, Jonathan Wolfe, Why Read Marx Today, and another one by our colleague, Alan Wood, the second edition of his book, Karl Marx in the Arguments of the Philosophers series, has just come out from Routledge. And any of those books will give you a good start on understanding Marx and Marxism.
start, because Mark says a huge corpus. So you, if you really want to get to the plumb the depths of this thing, you're in for a long haul. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134 or go to our, send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org. Joe, before the break, you were talking about the, what you call the concentration of capital, right? How much, how did you put it, social value?
Social wealth
is held as capital. Marx says this beautiful thing, in the Marx and Engels say this beautiful thing in the Communist Manifesto about how capitalism has, I don't remember the exact words, but driven out every other form of valuation and reduced all relations between man and man to calculations of naked self-interest or something like that, which strikes me as right, or more or less right. But other things have survived. I mean, here's Marx the prophet. Other things have survived. I mean, we still have families, you know. We still, there are people still go to church. People still regard others as fellow members of a neighborhood. So there's more than just calculations of naked self-interest that bind man to man. Isn't there? I mean, so wasn't Marx overestimating the concentration of capital?
Well, the concentration of capital is unlikely ever to be complete and entire. And it is said, I've never actually found this text myself, but I've been told that Marx thought that there must be many things of great value even under capitalism. That if there was, or to put it the other way around, if there was nothing of value under capitalism, there'd be no hope for communism either.
Yeah.
So there must be pockets of value even in the capitalist system. But, you know, the real significance, I think, for us in this idea of the concentration of capital is that it relates to the idea of economic growth, and that, you know, while we think that capitalism is growing and growing in some important sense, Marx would argue that a lot of this is simply things being sucked into the capitalist sector.
Right.
So things that we never had to pay for before, we now have to pay for. That counts as economic growth.
I want to read an email from Sylvia to indicate that some people still hold the view, as she says it, Marxism is viable. China still has many aspects of overall planning. So does Vietnam. Cuba is barely making it, not because they believe in socialism, but because of problems due to American embargoes. Let's consider what new democratic socialism, such as some Scandinavian countries have, might be like to benefit mankind. That's Sylvia by email.
What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think every economy there has ever been has had to have elements of the market and elements of planning. It's really a matter of getting the balance right. That the Soviet Union tried to plan everything. They couldn't manage, and it survived only as long as it did because of the black market. If there hadn't been a black market, it would have collapsed decades before. And even the most supposedly ruthless capitalist countries in the world have huge amounts of planning as well. The central banks, aspects of the economy are under a huge amount of federal control, you may recognize. So there's no such thing as a complete free market. There's no such thing as a complete planned economy. The Scandinavian economies are capitalist, but they do have the welfare state and a very successful one.
We have some callers on the line. We're getting near the bottom of the hour. Let's take a few callers. Mark in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark. You there, Mark? I don't think we have Mark. Greg in San Francisco, are you on the line?
Yeah, this is a question for the guest. You know, when I think about all of the existing communist/socialist systems in the world, they seem to have developed in tandem with the personality cult. In other words, like Castro in Cuba, Kim Jong-il in North Korea, Mao in China. And I'm wondering, what would Marx have to say about that?
Yeah. Good question.
It's very interesting. I mean, the revolution I know most about is a Russian revolution. And there was a very active intellectual debate about what Marxism required at the time of revolution. And really, you know, the orthodox Marxists, the Mensheviks, argued that, you know, Russia was not ripe for the revolution because, you know, according to orthodox Marxist theory, you have to go through a capitalist phase first, then you can have the dictatorship of the proletariat. Whereas the Bolsheviks argued that this was, you know, dead doctrine, they had their opportunity, and so they should take it. So strictly speaking, the Russian Revolution wasn't a Marxist revolution. But having said that, you know, had Marx been sitting around the table and had the opportunity to participate in the revolution, I think he wouldn't have held back So we would probably have had the cult of Marx and not the cult of Lenin.
But you know, there is this thing where capitalism is supposed to be self-undermining, right? Because of the boom bust and the constant decline in profits and all that. And it's and also I read in your book, and I recall from being an undergraduate, that all these communist-like structures are supposed to develop within capitalism, right? Like, so, you know, like employee stock ownership kind of stuff, you know, health insurance schemes that maybe make, like, single payer. That's supposed to develop within, so it's supposed to prepare the way for the emergence of... Isn't that the story?
That's right. And for people who think that communism is impossible, they should start thinking about, you know, the large corporation, or what Marx called the joint stock company. Because the point of the joint stock company is that a single company can be owned by hundreds of thousands, even millions of people, yet managed by someone else in the interests of all these people. You have the divorce of ownership and management. And in a way, you know, this is all that communism needs, and we've already got it under capitalism. This doesn't seem to be recognized by defenders of capitalism in the same way.
Chad in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chad.
Hi, thanks. If the purpose of production, or economic production, is consumption, and if labor is needed for production, and therefore labor then can consume the products of its production, what happens when we automate more and more and eliminate the need for labor, and how do then workers and people get the economic means to consume?
Excellent question, Chad. Thanks for the question. Joe, I know you got an answer to that one.
Yes, just desperately thinking of it.
isn't this one of the basic problems with Marx's theory, that he predicts the less labor involved, the more the cost will go up, when it seems like it's just the opposite?
Well, Marx says all sorts of things about labor, and they're not all consistent. I mean, one of the most stimulating, inspiring ideas that Marx has is that in the future society, the distinction between work and leisure will be eroded. And as academics, you know, we can see this. I mean, are you this minute involved in work or leisure or both or neither? I mean, the distinction, in a way, for many people in the professions has disappeared. This is not so for people who work on the production line. So part of Marx's idea is that work in the future should be so fulfilling that people don't even think of it as work. In terms of automation, being able to get rid of work, I think Marx recognized that telling the workers that in the future there'll be no distinction between work and leisure wasn't going to rally them to the revolutionary cause. So he promised them less work. But the interesting thing is, you know, we have automation, increasing automation year by year, less labor is needed, but this turns to profit, not to workers' leisures.
Right. I think that's an important point. And, you know, it seems to me that maybe we're at the point where we might contemplate a true Marxist revolution, but, you know, unfortunately, Jonathan, we're out of time, and I'm gonna have to say goodbye to you. Our guest has been Professor Jonathan Wolfe of University College London. Jonathan is the author of Why Read Marx Today. Thanks so much for joining us on Philosophy Talk, Jonathan.
Well, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So, John, what you learned today?
Well,
you ready to man the barricades?
What I learned today has to be added to what I learned in my desperate reading of Alan Wood's book over the last week. Marx is a pretty powerful philosopher with a lot of good ideas. I particularly am intrigued by the idea of alienation. I'm particularly put off by this utopianism. I think if religion is a utopia, is the opiate of the masses, then utopia has become kind of a secular opiate of the masses.
Yeah.
We kind of suffer through things because we have some strange vision of perfection in the future.
I think that Marx's criticism of capitalism is deep and profound, and is becoming more true as capitalism enriches many people around the world, but grinds down workers in many places. And I do think it has the seeds of its own undoing, just not ready to be undone quite yet. This discussion continues online at www.philosophytalk.org. That's philosophytalk.org.
Paper bag was on my knee. Man, I had a dreadful life.
Ken, what's that drumming?
That's not drumming, John. That's conundrumming.
Ah, that part of Philosophy Talk where we talk to people who have philosophical problems or puzzles that they want to discuss.
And we help them think it through. And we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Peter.
Hi there.
Peter, where are you from?
I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, our favorite city north of San Francisco, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. What do you do up there in Portland now, Peter?
Well, I'm actually setting up my booth at the State Fair in Washington State this week.
Setting up your booth even as we speak, is that right?
As we speak.
Because I thought I heard a cow or something in the background.
You could well do.
So tell us your conundrum, Peter.
Well, my conundrum is that I get concerned when I hear people talking about issues. Because it seems to me that when I'm talking about issues, there's always a limited choices. Like, for example, most issues have a choice of one or two.
Peter, you're thinking about issues on TV and issues on the news and those kinds of issues?
Political issues kind of things?
Oh, it could be any kind of issue where there's an element of anxiety, something like the threat of war, gay marriage, women's rights, literally anything that causes us to go, In the state of excitement, we jump to conclusions, we make assumptions. The way we talk about issues is as though there are only two choices. One is right, the other's wrong.
As I understand, what you're thinking about of an issue is it's always an issue that is at least presented as requiring some action. That is, like, for example, the issue of gay marriage as well. There's some action required.
Do we have to ban them or permit them?
Ban them or permit them. And so there's really two sides to every issue. It's kind of a more complicated thing. There's the issue itself, and then there's what to do. And those things can get kind of blurred.
Yeah, let me try something. Here we are. We're divided. These questions about gay marriage. And we present the issue as either you're for it or against it.
Yes.
And we divide ourselves into these warring camps, right?
Yes.
And you said, well, but there are an infinity of possible outcomes.
Yes.
I don't know if that's really true. But there are lots of different outcomes. And if we didn't phrase it as a yes-no question, we might find a point of convergence in which we could all rally around and all promote. And we'd have a public discourse that aimed at trying to reach points of convergence.
Which are not part of the issue. They're part of something else.
They're part of how we're going to live together. They're part of our shared life.
Well, now maybe say, look, what you're really recommending is the philosophical approach. When you're in a truly philosophical mood and an issue comes up, you don't think of it as an opportunity for action, but an opportunity for contemplation. It's really, on the whole, much more fun to contemplate issues than to do anything about them. Yeah. I mean, suppose in the Iraq case we had just contemplated. If we'd done that, we'd all be better off.
I don't think we could stop.
Contemplation over decision.
No. Contemplation is a darn good thing. Aristotle said contemplation is the highest form of human good.
Emerson says that the infinite lies in sweet repose at all times.
Oh, yeah. You guys are touchy-feely guys here.
Now, why am I missing?
You're not missing his point, but you're missing my point.
Oh, okay.
And my point is, I think Peter's onto something. Yeah, if we think together more, you know, if we think together about how we want to be, how we want to arrange our lives, what's at stake,
and listen to each other,
and we don't say, here's a yes-no question, we'll have a better society. We'll have a better life. We'll have a better culture. Philosophizing is the key to being able to do that. We should philosophize together. That's the key to democracy.
Hume said, I mean, I'm not sure what he was saying it about. He said, sloth and indifference are the great guides to life.
So no, he didn't.
Well, he did in a way.
He said.
He said, if you think hard and long about what your reasons are for doing things, you'll find you don't have any good philosophical reasons for doing anything. But anyway,
Peter, I hope we've confused you enough.
Contemplation over action. I think we should have a new political party.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's have a contemplocracy instead of a democracy.
You're in rare form today. Okay,
all right.
Bye-bye. If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse. Or just send email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, Peter Crimmins, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and members of KALW Information Radio 91.7 San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program, however reasonable and true, do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.